This is Emily Kreider, and today I'm joined by my roommate, Madeline.
Hi.
Today's podcast is called Madness and Mayhem, or the story of an English legend, the ultimate metaphorical dance battle, and the strangest coincidence of the 20th century. So for starters, when you think of Gotham, what generally comes to mind?
Well, for me, and I guess a lot of people that you would ask that question, I think of Batman. But from your general tone and the fact that I'm doing this right now, I'm going to guess that there's a lot more to it.
I mean, yeah, that tends to be the modern association. But initially, it was not anything to do with superheroes at all. The story of Gotham actually begins with a small town in England called Godham, which translates to Home of Goats. It's a village of about 1,600 people in Nottinghamshire, about 3 hours north of London. At the beginning of the 13th century, King John, who had just been crowned King of England, was planning to travel to his hunting lodge in Nottingham.
I know that guy. He's the lion, right? From Robin Hood?
Yeah, the Disney version?
Yeah.
Yep, that's him. However, to get there, he and his whole caravan would have to travel through Godham. According to Caroline Lowbridge, a journalist for the BBC, any road that the king traveled on became a kind of public highway of sorts.
Fancy.
Right? And invasive, honestly. Like, the king just decides to go through your village, and all of a sudden everyone thinks they can go through your village. Like, rude. Like a highway going through your front yard. Like, you don't want that, but you don't have a choice because the king decided he wanted that.
Yes. This is my road now.
So, naturally, the villagers, not liking the idea of their lovely little town getting trampled all over by strangers, decided to, feign madness.
As you do.
Because insanity was thought to be contagious at the time, so of course, when word spread that this whole town had gone crazy all of a sudden, the king was like, maybe not, and took a different route to Nottingham. Lowbridge notes some of the weird stuff the villagers did to quote-unquote prove their madness and keep people away, like build a fence around a bush in order to keep a cuckoo bird from escaping, and trying to drown an eel in a nearby pond.
Where does one get an eel?
I don't know. Like, who piped up in the town meeting when they were discussing ideas and was like, hey guys, I have this eel we could use. Like, who even has eels?
Like, catching eels in the first place and then says, you know what, I'm gonna go put this back in the water.
And try to drown it.
Yes.
Know. Do they even have eels in England? Is that a thing?
I don't know.
So many questions. The stories of Godham's hijinks spread by word of mouth for a few generations, kind of solidifying their place in local and national legend. Eventually, they were recorded in different books, such as The Merry Tales of the Madmen of Godham, which was published in 1565. In the 1700s, there was even a Mother Goose nursery rhyme written about the villagers, who became known as the Wise Men of Godham. It goes, 3 wise men of Godham, they went to sea in a bowl, and if the bowl had been stronger, my song would have been longer.
That's it?
That is it, because you don't need anything else to explain just how wise they were.
Wise men.
So that brings us to Washington Irving. Washington Irving was born April 3rd, 1783, the same year the American Revolution ended, hence his name. Uh-huh. Very creative. He's well known for his satiric writings and commentary on American politics, religion, and education, and is considered a key developer of the American ghost story through his short stories, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow and Rip Van Winkle. Classic. Mm. From January 1807 to January 1808, Irving, his older brother William, and James Kirk Paulding, who would later become the U.S. Secretary of the Navy, published a satiric periodical and literary magazine titled Sal Magundy or the Whim Whams and Opinions of Lancelot Langstaff, Esquire, and Others.
Okay. Some of those names is a mouthful.
Yeah, it really is. It just keeps going and going forever.
The Whim Whams.
And Opinions of Lancelot Langstaff, Esquire.
He couldn't just be Lancelot Langstaff. He had to, Lancelot Langstaff, Esquire.
And that's how I read the voice in my head, is that accent whenever I read his work. It's all very done up. Mm. Yes. And the U.S. Secretary of the Navy was part of this whole thing? I think that's funny to me.
That's who we put our military trust in.
Oh yes, I trust him.
He knows his things. He's an esquire.
Additionally, salmagundi is actually the name of a common food at the time, a dish of chopped meat, anchovies, eggs, onions, and seasoning, because seasoning helps all those other things taste better, apparently.
That's kind of gross.
It really is. It's also a colloquial term for a combination of miscellaneous individualistic parts.
That makes more sense.
Yeah, it applies to the literary magazine aspect of all these, this collection of very different stories and articles and stuff. Irving, who had read the stories about the wise men of Gotham, was the first to refer to New York City as Gotham in the November 11th, 1807 edition of Salmagundi. In this edition, he published a short story titled Chapter 6 of the Chronicles of the Renowned and Ancient City of Gotham, which had the accompanying subtitle, How Gotham City Conquered Was and How the Folk Turned Apes.
Conquered was? And what even are the first five chapters of the Chronicles of Gotham about?
There aren't actually five chapters before, it's just this one. And you'll see why there's just one in just a few seconds. Essentially, the story follows an alternative history explaining how Gotham was drawn into madness. It was all a result of an invasion by the Hopping Toes, which is spelled Hopping Tots, a group of migratory people that Irving describes as, quote, specially noted for being right valorous in all exercises of the leg.
So, never skipping leg day.
Not once. And we'll see why in just a second. The Hopping Toes, led by noble warriors Pirouet and Rigadoon, yes, those are their names, seeing Gotham as a kind of figurehead for edible and monetary treasures, decide naturally to conquer it.
As one does.
As one does. The best part of the story is that Pirouet and Rigadoon are like, this is going to be so easy, Gotham's just like Achilles, it has weak heels. The whole story is full of just heel, foot, and leg puns, the whole thing. It's like the pinnacle of 21st century humor. If Irving lived now, he'd fit in with meme culture so well. So well.
I'm trying so hard to be witty and think of a foot pun, but I cannot.
That's probably a good thing. So then the whole group marches down to Gotham, where, meanwhile, the people of Gotham are freaking out because they'd just been conquered before by a similar group of people called the Jighees. Naturally. Washington Irving was the least subtle writer probably ever, honestly. The Jighees? Really? So let's add dancing puns to that former leg, heel, and foot puns that we had. Dancing.
I'm about as good at coming up with puns now as I was 20 seconds ago.
So Gotham, in preparation for battle, sends out their finest dancers to face the Hopping Toes. Irving directly references the Mother Goose nursery rhyme in this section, writing, quote, but so it did happen by great mischance that divers light-heeled youth of Gotham, more especially those who are descended from the three wise men, so renowned of yore for having most venturesomely voyaged over sea in a bull, were, from time to time, captured and inveigled into the camp of the enemy, where being foolishly cajoled and treated for a season with outlandish disports and pleasantries, they were sent back to their friends, entirely changed, degenerated, and turned topsy-turvy. The war for Gotham ramps up. The Hopping Toes attempt to overcome the garrison through the might of the waltz and eventually conquer with the force of a grand ball, consisting of a flurry of Cossack dances, fandangos, and gavottes. Once all the women of the town have been thoroughly won over by the enemy's superior moves, Gotham has been taken, as Irving so simply states, by a coup de pied, by force of legs.
So it's like mating dances and birds. You gotta go with whoever has the fancier moves. Like, I can just see the women going up to their husbands and like, honey, I love you, but he's just so fancy.
Honestly, there's no way we can compete, so I guess, you know, the jig is up. Oh my gosh, we did it.
Yes!
Irving concludes with a brief commentary on the present state of Gotham, aka New York City. The people are consumed by folly. The young people, as good intentioned as they are for the improvement of their mental faculties, are, in the end, reduced to robots, unable to resist or sit still while there is music to dance to and parties to attend. That's how thoroughly the Hopping Toes corrupt.
The youth these days, with their dancing and their music.
Yeah, I think it's funny, because honestly, generations don't really change. Like, it's the same way now. Like, we're always out, well, we're not, but most people are always out partying and, And it's always the same complaints of we don't know what we're doing with our lives and we're wasting our days having fun. We should be working and earning our keep.
It's Footloose all over again.
See, this is Footloose. This is literally like instead of one guy going to a town and changing everything, it's a whole army coming and changing the town. But it's the same idea. Like dancing will save you, except not really.
Except those guys were right. Dancing did destroy the town.
It's true. Literally. And their wives and took their children and corrupted them. Yeah, it's fine. In the end, Irving more or less just took the idea of a town historically associated with foolishness and stupidity and twisted it into a metaphor for New York City's growing reputation as the center of high society and role as one of America's largest centers of international business, a change that he reimagined as a literal invasion of overabundant ridiculousness.
So he definitely had a high opinion of all the people who lived in New York.
Oh, yeah, for sure. As someone who grew up and spent most of his life upstate, he would naturally have a very high opinion of city slickers. Additionally, Irving scholar Mary Weatherspoon Bowden notes the strategic timing of the issue's release on November 11th. Irving, the political satirist that he was, revealed his personal disdain for the politics of the Democratic Republican Party, which was commonly referred to as the French Party, due in part to their French sympathies, by infusing subtle commentary into his story, quote, describing the conquest of Godin by the Hopping Toes, a race which had committed numerous offenses against frogs, one which is composed of agile dancers and whose marching song is the Saw era.
So we're just hitting all of the French stereotypes right on the nose here.
Yes, cover all of the offensive American jokes about France.
We've always hated them.
Really, honestly, things have not changed.
We've got the frog leg thing. We've got dancing.
Frou-frou Frenchmen.
And the Sa era?
Yeah, it's a French battle song they used to sing when they were waging wars, little battles against the government.
Storming the Bastille.
Oh, yes. I think it actually originated during the French Revolution, so that would make sense.
All right, then.
A week after the issue's publication, the Democratic Republican Party, parodied here by Irving, won the majority of the elections for New York City officials, while the Federalists only clung to a few of the boroughs. Also, fun fact, Irving was one of the journalists present in Aaron Burr's 1807 trial for treason after Burr's plans to help Mexico overthrow Spanish power in the Southwest were discovered. Irving, who was in his mid-20s at the time, tended toward Federalist ideas and generally disagreed with Burr's wishy-washy Democratic-Republican politics. He didn't think Burr was guilty of treason, though, and mostly just pitied him as a man who had fallen from grace.
Well, falling from grace is generally what tends to happen when you duel a man, kill him, and then hide out in New Jersey for a bit until it all blows over. So where does Batman come in? Because it's definitely Gotham City there. Does that actually have any relationship to this?
Yeah, it actually does. So Batman was created in 1939, started out saving an unnamed city, which was specifically named New York after about four issues. The setting was changed to Gotham City, pronunciation changed as well, in 1940 after Batman writer Bill Finger spotted the name Gotham Jewelers in a phone book. At this point, Gotham was already a well-known nickname for New York City, so it really wasn't that surprising of a change. However, it wasn't until 1996, in the Batman Chronicles number 6, that the link to the little town in England was first addressed. The story with King John wasn't told until 2006 in Legends of the Dark Knight number 206.
That's a lot of sixes. But they did talk about King John and Batman. How'd they manage to work that into the story?
In that particular issue, the villain, Eric Gavlin, who's also a member of the Wise Men of Gotham, dedicates his expository monologue to detailing the historic irony behind Gotham City sharing a name with a little town in England. It really is interesting that even though Batman's Gotham wasn't explicitly named after the place in the legend, both share the reputation for being home to crazy people. So it was actually just a really weird coincidence in the end, probably one of the strangest and coolest connections that most people will never know about. It just goes to show that 13th century English legend transcribed into 19th century American historical context can still resonate with 21st century audiences. The connection may not always seem evident, but if you're willing to kind of peel back those layers, it has a way of revealing greater meaning underneath. Well, that about wraps it up for this podcast. Thanks for coming in, Madeline.
No problem.
Thank you for tuning in. Bye.